We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Today is Saturday, the 29th of June in the glorious future year of 2024, and this is your regularly scheduled Publius coming to you this time by pre-recording, because I am heading out to the stamp show, and I don't want to try to rush back. Now, my plan had been to go to the stamp show on Friday, after my Hear Now the Word show. Well, I went to see where I had a printable list of the stamps that I want, so that I could just give those to dealers with my contact information, and I couldn't find it anywhere, so I had to spend some time retyping that, and various things happened. Anyway, and then when I got on the road, realizing I have to drive all the way to Richardson, which is on the very other side of the metro mess, the first thing that happened was I ran into a traffic jam. And at that point, I threw up my hands and said, "Nope, I'm going home. I'm going to try again tomorrow." So this is going to be a fairly rough show, and I always say that when it's pre-recorded, but this time it really is true, because I am not going to go back and spend 3 hours carefully editing out all the breathing noises and that kind of thing, which I usually do, partly because I tend to record a show which is too long unless I go back and edit it out all those little gaps, all those little infelicities where I change my mind about what I was going to say, and I can't do this in a live show, of course, but in the pre-recorded show, I can just go back and rearrange the show so that I sound a lot more coherent than I really am. Now, I'm not going to make any references to politicians who have trouble speaking coherently and making sense. You can fill all of those that you want in yourself. But, speaking of postage, we have a mail call. Yes, I got mail from Tobe, which is usually discernible because of the bodhisattvas and mandalas and so on the outside of the envelope. Tobe is a true artist with rubber stamps. I think that's what he's using. They might be linoleum blocks. Either way, multicolored, all kinds of nice stuff. You ever get mail from Tobe, it's good mail. No doubt about that. Anyway, what did Tobe send me? Well, he sent me an Otoshidama envelope, which is the sort of envelope, it's red with gold printing on it, which Chinese, Japanese, Far Eastern folks use to give gifts of money at New Year's time. And he sent me a United States Postal Service mailing envelope with the 25-cent space hologram cachet. And, of course, as you know, I use that kind of envelope to send out various things, particularly to my Patreon supporters. So I may just fill it up with stickers and send it right back to Tobe. And also included in the envelope was a letter made up to be read under ultraviolet light. Yes, Tobe sent me a letter written in invisible ink, because he knows perfectly well that I have black lights coming out of my ears. Given that I have a sizable collection of uranium glass, it's not that difficult of an inference to draw. But the black light letter says, well, it's printed in an ink that glows yellow under ultraviolet, and the only thing wrong with this is that modern writing paper is typically fairly ultraviolet sensitive. But he says, "Thought you might need some envelopes. Odd things do fall into my lap." And notes that he was writing with a Rapidograph. It looks like a Rapidograph 4 1.20, signed Tobe. And so, yes, if you ever receive mail from Tobe, and you can't figure out what is going on, you might try playing a black light over it. There may be messages which are not visible to the ordinary unaided eye. Let's see. In the field of what is going on with me, I regret to announce that it is very likely I am a hair's breadth or a nail paring away from making this decision definitively. Very likely that I am not going to Buffalo, New York for the North American Science Fiction Convention, which is going to be held in the third week of July. Why? Well, it's all really my fault in that I just didn't get in touch with people early enough. And so when I finally did contact the people in charge of exhibits and displays, I was told, sorry, we have no room for your display. And I found out the reason why I never received any communications from them, well, science fiction conventions normally send out progress reports to members, and I knew I was a member. I knew I had signed up for full membership last year in Winnipeg, in among all the other things I was doing in Winnipeg. Well, as it turns out, apparently their publications person quit without producing any publications, so nobody got any publications. But this doesn't explain why the chair didn't send out an email. Firstly, it doesn't explain why the chair didn't send around an email to everybody who was registered, or a postcard to those who didn't have email addresses saying, hey, we need a publications person, this is important. But it also doesn't explain why nobody sent around an email saying, for example, this is the deadline for registering to interest in participating in the program. Well, I missed that. Nobody sent around an email saying, if you want to get your exhibits in, we got to hear from you now. Anyway, and again, it's not necessarily their fault, right? I could have gone to their website at any time. And unfortunately, with other things that were going on, I didn't. And the result is that I also don't have hotel or travel arrangements made. Now, I am no stranger to making those things at the last minute in order to go to a convention. That's 2-3 weeks was about how far in advance I made my arrangements to go to Melbourne back in 2010. So I'm no stranger to doing that. I'm not at all averse to doing that. But it looks like I probably won't be doing it this time. And it's a pity, because I would have had fun at the convention. I'm sure I would have had fun at the convention. And I had a kind of elaborate scheme planned out, where during the time between the NASFIC and the Worldcon, which is in Glasgow in the second week of August, I would travel around southern Canada, because I wanted to take the tour that they have during the summer at the Bruce Nuclear Power Station, and I've been told that there is a visitor center one can visit at the Pickering Nuclear Power Station, and I would like to do both of those things. At this point, it looks very unlikely that I will, unless my method of getting to Munich, from where I'm going to pick up the stuff I need for the Glasgow Convention, rather than carrying it all the way across the Atlantic with me, might be to take a flight from Dallas-Fort Worth to Detroit Wayne Airport, and then rent a car there and do that stuff for 2 or 3 days, and then come back and take an onward flight to Germany. Because it is sometimes feasible to get relatively cheap flights to Munich by way of Detroit. So I am still considering that part of it. But I'm afraid that I'm not going to Buffalo. And I did my standard thing, right, where I say, you're still asking for volunteers to run this, this, and this. I'm willing to run it if it means that I can do my display. But the Buffalo folks said, no, we have no space. I mean, on the website, this says they have 22,000 square feet of exhibit space. Divide that by 10 for square meters. But they say, no, all of our space is already taken. And my experience of conventions is that that's not likely to be true. In other words, if I were to just show up with all my stuff, there is a good chance that there would be space for me to put it up. But I don't necessarily feel like taking all that stuff with me on a supposition rather than with a promise that I'll be able to do it. Not to mention, of course, given that I'm going to be doing some travel adventure in Europe after the Worldcon, it does make sense to not have to haul all that stuff with me to Buffalo as baggage and then send half of it home because I have the equivalent already in Europe. What I might do is attend the Anime Fest convention, which is being held here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which is going to conflict with the NASFIC. It usually conflicts with the NASFIC or the Worldcon. And I might still be able to get space there to do a setup. So that's sort of the second string to my bow, as it were. Now, you're going to ask me, well, what about Glasgow? Were you behindhand with Glasgow as well? Well, yes, I was behindhand with Glasgow, to the point that I only realized this past week that I actually had to buy a membership, that I had not actually done that yet. But I did that, and I contacted the people at Glasgow to say, hey, I have an exhibit I want to bring. What kind of space can you make available? And they sent back saying, well, show us some pictures and we'll try and figure out how we can fit you in. So I do certainly hope to have a display at Glasgow. I told them I have quite some interesting material, particularly local interest involving the, well, local for Scotland, not local for Glasgow, involving the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority's fast reactor program with the Dounreay fast reactor and the prototype fast reactor up in the northern highlands of Scotland at Caithness. Again, not really local for Glaswegians, but at least it's more local. Just as last year in Winnipeg, I devoted a lot of space in my display to the Atomic Energy of Canada Limited research station at Whiteshell, which is in Manitoba. It's not really close to Winnipeg, but nothing is really close to Winnipeg. Winnipeg is out there in the middle of the prairie. Let's see, what else is there to talk about? Well, as you may have heard, the Boeing CST-100 is still stuck at the International Space Station, although Boeing's vice presidents and so on who are talking about it continue to insist that they're not actually stuck. But the service module is supposed to have a 45-day operating life, and they are talking about extending that by another 45 days. How exactly is unclear, because that 45-day operating life is based on the lifespan of batteries which are required for critical operations during the descent maneuver. And it's not clear to me that those are replaceable. Maybe they're just saying, well, you know, 45 days is the spec, but we think they're good for 90. They may, in fact, be doing qualification tests, because, of course, a lot of space-rated hardware is like that. You launch a Mars rover or a Voyager probe or something with a rated life of 90 days for a Mars rover and is still running 3 years later. So, that's not implausible. But, on the other hand, it certainly makes you think when SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft might stay up at the ISS for months at a time, it makes you ask, why did Boeing not build that capability into their spacecraft? Because sort of the ignominious ending for Boeing is having an unmanned landing of the CST-100 and then having their two crewmen come home on the next scheduled Dragon landing, which isn't until March of next year. Stuck in the sky is not really a good look. It wasn't a good look when the Soviet Union collapsed and you had guys up on Mir who couldn't come back because there was no country for them to come back to. It's certainly not a good look if Boeing has to admit that they send people into space on a defective spacecraft, when Boeing is a well-established aerospace company which always at least used to have an excellent reputation. And their competitor, to be blunt, is Elon Musk. That, I keep having to say, you have to separate SpaceX from pretty much everything else the guy does, because there are a lot of extremely committed people inside SpaceX who are not going to allow him to ruin it for them. Now, in the Wall Street Journal the other day, I was very pleased to read something that confirms what I've been saying for literally 20 years now. I do believe if I went back and look in my notes, I was penciling this out in 2004. Thales Alenia, which is a European defense and aerospace conglomerate. It's intermeshed in every way with Airbus and Ariane Space and so on. Thales Alenia has come back with the results of a study in which they say that the place to build big new data centers is in orbit, where you can power them with solar power and not worry about basically cooling water or any of those other issues that people get exercised about. And I have literally been saying this for long enough that back in 2004, I was doing back-of-the-envelope cost calculations for such a thing. A manned, geosynchronous, gigawatt space platform with a huge antenna so that you could do very narrow-focused spot beams and thus reuse the same frequencies over and over and over and over again. You're talking about spot beams focused down to maybe, you know, I mean, very, very narrow foci, probably overlapping. I mean, the closest you could reasonably get them would maybe be 1 to 2 kilometers, but you can have a second spot and a third spot in a nearby frequency overlapping them. Anyway, talk to somebody who's really into antenna design sometime if you want to talk about these kinds of things. It's not easy, but you're talking about a transmitting antenna which could be 3 or 4 kilometers on a side. Because, of course, it would be basically a very lightweight framework. Anyhow, I said then that the place for data centers was in orbit because there's an assumption made that latency is important for data centers, and for most purposes it isn't. Most of the content today, most of the traffic today on the internet is things like streaming video. Streaming video doesn't care about latency. You hit play and there's a few seconds of buffering, and the difference between the time that it takes for a radio signal to go up to geosynchronous orbit and come back down and the time that it takes for a light signal in a fiber optic cable to get to the nearby metropolitan data center and back don't actually matter to streaming video. They matter in other applications, but they don't matter in the applications that are using up the bulk of the bandwidth today. Now, orbital data centers aren't going to be happening anytime soon, I don't think, but it is one very plausible application for the SpaceX Super Heavy booster and something resembling their Starship spacecraft, much more plausible than going to Mars in the near term. I'm sorry to say that the Dear Moon people, that Japanese very wealthy media personality who was going to charter a Starship flight and fly it around the moon with a bunch of people chosen by random drawing from the internet, they have canceled that mission, and I'm not surprised. It was always a long shot. As I keep saying, my lunar settlement proposal does not require any new development. Now, it does require a variant of the Centaur, which has never been built, but it is very close to variants that have been built. It requires a large diameter Centaur with restartable engines and a couple of other modifications, but all of these features are features which have been done, or at least heavily worked on, at some time in the past, remembering that Centaur has a design history that goes back to the 1950s and a flight history that goes back to the 60s with the Surveyor lunar landers. But the idea of having your data center in orbit, that's really the practical way of doing it with solar power. And you have some interesting questions, of course, about legal regimes, but I just keep saying that, at a very minimum, you can cache things. You know, you don't even necessarily have to have as much equipment as you'd imagine if things are being cached. In other words, a popular YouTube video, you don't take it from Google's server farm in Altamont or wherever, up the satellite uplink to the satellite and then back down again every time, the way you do with CommSats. Instead, it goes up once and you update the comments or whatever, but the video stays up there. And so every time it's requested, it only has to come down. So the necessary uplink bandwidth is much less than the downlink bandwidth, simply because you have put up storage there. And I think that's the evolutionary step from the current system to, you know, basically dumb CommSats, which are nothing but relays, to CommSats with a cache. And that cache goes to terabytes and then gets much larger than that. And then you begin throwing in the processing power. And so at some point, it basically becomes economical to make this into a manned space station with a crew of two or three. You always have to have a buddy system if there's a possibility of vacuum work. But a crew of two or three who do maintenance and basically sit up there and are relieved every 3 to 6 months. Now, aside from that, there was a consideration that showed up towards the end of my last show that I wanted to bring up a little more. And I was talking about nuclear power plants which can and cannot handle primary frequency regulation responsibilities on a grid. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that in the context of closely versus loosely coupled systems. Because what I pointed out is that the Three Mile Island Unit 2 accident of 1979 shows very clearly that it was a closely coupled system. A feed water pump stopped, and that meant that feed water wasn't being delivered to the steam generators. Steam generator water level would drop rapidly in that case because the steam generators are what are called once-through types. And therefore, when the feed water pump stopped, the reactor was scrammed. But because the water was still boiling away merrily in the steam generators, each steam generator was removing from the primary loop a smaller and smaller amount of heat every moment, and so the pressure in the reactor loop began to rise, and that caused the relief valve to open, which ultimately caused the whole rest of the mess. And again, this was because in the Three Mile Island Unit 2, I always specify that, it was a completely different design from Three Mile Island Unit 1, and in fact had originally been planned for construction at Forked River in New Jersey. It was not originally planned for the Three Mile Island site. Anyway, TMI-2 was a very closely coupled system. There was a close connection between the reactor and the turbogenerator set. So the same thing could have happened if they suddenly got knocked off the grid, or if the grid load suffered a sudden disturbance, it could have caused a sudden pressure transient in the reactor loop, because those things are coupled very closely together. Whereas, for example, as I've said, at Bruce, on the shore of Lake Huron in Ontario, where they have 800 megawatt reactors, those reactors are very loosely coupled to the turbogenerators. And so each reactor turbine system has a dump condenser which can handle 100% of the reactor full steam load, so that if the turbine trips out, the steam will simply be diverted around the turbine to the condenser, and the reactor can run indefinitely in that configuration. Secondly, CANDUs in general have large boilers. I'm not sure if they're all natural circulation boilers, but I can tell you that the boilers have a large mass of water in them, steam drums and that kind of thing, which PWR steam generators generally don't have. The result is that in the case of a sudden disturbance, right, sudden increased demand for power, right, sudden opening of the turbine valves, that excess steam is, in the first instance, delivered from the drum. And then you can increase reactor power if necessary. But you don't go changing the reactor power just for a transient. Similarly, if the steam demand drops, What'll happen first is that it generates more heat is stored in the drum. And of course, again, that steam, if it's excessive, will be dumped to the condenser. That's the difference, right, is that a turbo generator trip, right, a loss of station service or something like that, would not necessarily cause you to have to stop the reactors at Bruce, whereas in a closely coupled system like TMI-2, you do have to stop the reactor. And of course, there are all kinds of intermediate positions. For example, the steam-generating heavy water reactor at Winfrith in Britain, which was a prototype for a CANDU-like system that never got off the ground because basically it required both heavy water and enriched uranium, making it excessively costly. The SGHWR was designed so that in case of loss of connection to the grid, or something similar, the reactor would back off to 40% power because the condenser was rated to accept 100% of reactor steam output for short periods and 40% indefinitely. So the reactor would back off to 40% power, the turbine would be kept steaming just enough to generate the power required for the power station itself. Again, that's a thing many people say nuclear power stations can't do, but they absolutely can if they're engineered to it. And then all the steam that wasn't needed would just be bypassed to the condenser. And again, that meant that once you reconnected, you wouldn't need to go through the whole startup procedure. It really is a nice situation. Anyhow, but there are lots of analogies to this in the world around us. Closely coupled versus loosely coupled systems. Systems that have fragility but are efficient versus systems which take up more space. Yeah, they take up more volume, they cost a bit more, but they're much more resilient. So the closely coupled system, an obvious example, would be just-in-time inventorying in manufacturing. Another one would be the current aviation industry, where they try to sell every seat, and therefore if one flight gets canceled, you can't get on to another flight. And the economics people, the business school people, love closely coupled systems because on paper, they look economic. They look like they save money. Precision railroading is another one. If you get one of these long no-fitter trains, doesn't fit on any siding in the division, it's got to go through. If something breaks down, it shuts down the entire division. The business school types love closely coupled systems. The way they work in the real world, unfortunately, doesn't necessarily pay back the level of confidence which has been reposed in them. And that's the polite way of saying it. Anyhow, you have been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnonRadio.net, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Every Saturday at 1900 UTC, just before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, I get on here and talk about the state of the world and humanity and technology and all those nice things, but mostly not computers. And I look forward to your cards and letters. Send them to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'll probably read them out on the air. I'll probably send you something in return. If you like these broadcasts enough to support them, paypal.me/PrometheusLives or patreon.com/man_and_Adam, assuming that you don't just want to send me cash or other bearer instruments in the mail. And don't forget my other show, Hear Now the Words, also on Anon Radio at 15 hours UTC, Tuesdays and Fridays, in which I read science fiction 100 years old or older and other things that catch my interest.
7.